It's 10:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For centuries, humankind has been looking for ways to extend life. Ponce de Leon, the famous Spanish explorer, supposedly spent a lot of time in Florida looking for the fountain of youth. Senior citizens still go to Florida, although I don't think they're any more likely to find that mythical fountain than Ponce de Leon was. But I digress. We humans have always wanted the answers to questions like who lives a long and healthy life and why. A new book may provide some answers to those questions, and some of those answers will surprise you. The book is titled The Longevity Project, Surprising Discoveries for Health and Long Life from the landmark 8-decade study by Howard Friedman and Leslie Martin. Joining me to talk about the findings reported in this book, one of its authors, Howard Friedman, Distinguished Professor of Psychology at the University of California, Riverside. Good morning, Professor, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. I'm glad to be with you.
So, what's the secret to a long and happy life? My mother seems to think it involves always having a clean handkerchief in your pocket.
Well, I'm calling you from California, and a lot of people come here also for the Fountain of Youth. But it's not so much where you live; it's kind of what you do. So we all know that there's a lot of variation in how long people live and how healthy they stay. And some people seem like they're friends and neighbors, and they succumb earlier and become ill. And other people seem to thrive and live long. And we're really talking here about a difference between people who thrive into their 70s and 80s and even 90s versus people in their 50s and 60s. So we're not just talking about really end-of-life kinds of things. So to try to look at this, we did the first scientific study that ever followed people for their whole lives from the time they were young children in 1921 through the end of the 20th century, 8 decades later. And we looked at all the different kinds of things we could get our hands on. There's a lot of information about their personalities, their social relationships, their marriages as they grew up, their careers, and all kinds of things like that. We found a lot of things that were surprising, and we wound up calling ourselves MythBusters. You want me to jump right in?
Well, we will. We're going to talk about those myths, but before that, I wanted to ask, why are we so fascinated with these questions?
Well, one of the things is that people who live long are usually the people who stay healthy. So it's a misconception to say, well, I don't care how long I live. I just want to live a fun, healthy life. Well, the people who live the fun, healthy lives, we turned out, were the people also who tended to live the longest. And if you look about, you want to see the health of a country or a state, the first thing public health authorities do is they go and say, well, how long do people live? What's the average life expectancy? So it's a really good indicator of not only the length of your life, but the quality of the health, and even it turned out, we found out, the fulfillment of people's lives.
Tell us about Professor Lewis Terman and his work with children, because that's kind of where this story starts.
Right. We owe a lot to Lewis Terman. He was a professor at Stanford University, and starting back in really around 1920, he said, I wonder how bright kids grow up. There was some misconceptions, and that they would grow up to be kind of weird people. And he said, no, maybe the brightest kids are the ones we need to nurture the most, because they're going to become the intellectual leaders and contributors to our society. So that was his original motivation. So he got all kinds of information about bright children. He collected, he invited about over 1,500 bright boys and girls, mostly in Los Angeles and San Francisco areas, into his studies. He tested them, made sure they weren't quite intelligent, and then he looked at what they were like. He had their parents rate them. He had their teachers rate them. He looked at their activities. He had medical exams, and he started tracking them to see how they would grow up. And he thought maybe he would do this for 5 or 10 years, and he did. But it turns out they've been followed every 5 to 10 years since. So Dr. Terman died in 1956, but other people have picked up the study and carried it on. And we joined it in about 1990, about 20 years ago, and we've made it into a health study. So that's why we call it the Longevity Project, because we saw who was still alive. And then we gathered the death certificates for those who had passed away, and we're still doing that. Pretty much all of them are gone now, and so we know who lived long, and who died young, and what they all died from. So what Terman set out to do to see how the kids would turn out in terms of their careers and their success, we turned also into a very detailed, the only really lifelong study of detailed study of Americans who thrive and live into old age.
Well, you mentioned the idea of being MythBusters, and there's some pretty common myths about what contributes to a long life, and you were able to prove a number of those faults. And I just wanted to go to the beginning of chapter 4 of your book, which is titled Happiness and Health. And you talk about a pair of children who were enrolled fairly early on in the Terman Project, one of whom was considered a happy child, the other was a more serious child, and the more serious child lived longer. And in fact, what it says here, it said you found that healthy people are happy, but happy people are not necessarily healthy. How can that be?
Well, we all know that happiness and health are correlated. There are a lot of studies of that, and we see it in our lives. And certainly people who are seriously depressed are going to head down very unhealthy pathways. But the real issue is, what do you do about that? So we often hear, cheer up, laugh, take it easy, you'll live longer, you'll stay healthier. But we didn't find that at all. We didn't find that it was the happiness that was causing the good health and long life. It wasn't cheer up, stop worrying, that made the difference. It turned out that people who lived an involved, meaningful life, often quite hard work and quite stressful, those children grew up to be both healthy and happy. So it was not at all the happiness that was causing the health, but it was other underlying patterns that caused both the happiness and the health. And that's really, I think, a big breakthrough, because right now people emphasize being cheery all the time. And we found that the people who thrived and had the most successful lives in a lot of different dimensions were not the people who were cheery all the time, were trying artificially to cheer themselves up. They were, in fact, people who were involved in meaningful kinds of activities, often helping other people, very socially involved, and that led them to be both healthy, but also turned out they were most content looking back on their lives.
What were some of the other major findings or key findings in this study?
Well, one of the ones that was really surprising was about personality. So there had been a lot of speculation about type A behavior, the so-called coronary prone behavior, and other kinds of dimensions that make, we all know that some people thrive and some people seem to have one problem after another. So we looked in very detail, both in childhood and in young adulthood, at the personality characteristics of these 1,500 participants. And it turned out that the best personality predictor of health and long life was what we call conscientiousness. So these were people who were prudent and planning. They were involved in some ways serious, but also they were very persistent. So if you have a child and that child is focused, persistent, striving, serious, that turned out to be a really healthy predictor, as opposed to the kids who were more too cheery and lackadaisical and the kind of cut-ups. Those kids were really sometimes really sociable, and parents were thrilled with them, but then it turned out they went down unhealthy paths. So that has launched a lot of other studies, and there's actually some worldwide attention now in different research labs to see what it is about these people who are really clearly very prudent and persistent and conscientious that makes them stay healthy. And we have some good ideas about why that might be, but it's still being studied.
So let's talk about some of the myths that you busted in this book. One is, you'll worry yourself sick.
Well, we didn't find that. Often, especially for men, if you were facing some kind of problem, it was very good to be a worrier, not excessive worry, but the people who were more easygoing, oh, I'm going to take it easy, everything's going to turn out all right, they tended to engage in more risky behaviors. But the people, even like, for example, the men who were widowed, if they were kind of a worrying types, they took better care of themselves and they stayed healthier and lived longer. So we think it's a big problem to tell people, don't worry about anything, relax, don't stress, it's going to keep you healthy. We didn't find that at all. The people who were prudently worrying, and they tended to take care of themselves. Another interesting aspect of all this, though, of course it was true that the people who were more prudent and somewhat worrying. They were less likely to become heavy drinkers and smokers and real risk takers. But we also found that they stayed healthier for other reasons, and one of them was that they were more likely to engage and develop good social relationships. So the more stable people tended to enter stable marriages. They had better marriages. They had better social relationships. They had more friends. Whereas the totally unserious people with the extreme senses of cheerfulness and sense of humor, those people kind of lurched from one problem to another. So that was a really interesting kind of finding, that being serious and involved and committed actually led to good health in a lot of different ways.
We're talking about the new book, The Longevity Project, Surprising Discoveries for Health and Long Life from the landmark 8-decade study, written by Howard Friedman and Leslie Martin. We have Howard Friedman with us this hour, wondering what you think about living a long life. Does it matter to you? Do you think about, gee, how long do I think I'm going to live? Is that something you think about? What do you think would, what do you assume would go into a long life that would make your life longer? Are you doing certain things with an eye toward being able to extend your life? You want to make sure that you're healthy and happy and so forth? Or do you are you curious about what it takes to live a longer and healthier life? We're going to try to answer some of those questions this hour and talk about some of the discoveries that were made in this 8-decade-long study that included some 1,500 test subjects. Here's how you get involved with the program, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can also find us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Facebook show page, and you can leave a message there, and we'll pass it along to the audience. When I say we, that's not the royal we. That's we, meaning the producers put it on my screen and then I read it. So the show is a team effort here. Anyway, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. As I said, my guest is Howard Friedman. And, Professor, one of the other myths we need to exercise more, and that's going to solve our longevity problem. If you're a gym rat, or if you're somebody who works out constantly, you're going to live longer than someone who doesn't.
Well, of course, exercise is good. It keeps you healthy, and we did find that, but not in the ways that people often think about it. So if you love exercising and really thrilled with those activities, then keep doing it. We found that that's really fine. But most people don't like to do that, right? You say, get up and go to the gym at 6 a.m. or go jogging at 6 a.m. in the morning, and people just don't want, a lot of people don't want to do that, or they make a resolution they're going to do that, and then, you know, pretty much a few weeks later, the gym is empty. So we looked for the first time at patterns across people's lives. What were you doing not just last 6 months ago, but what were you doing 10 years ago, 20 years ago, even when you were a child? And a lot of interesting things came out in the Longevity Project. One is that the more active children tended to be more active adults. So there's some stability of physical activity levels across the lifespan, and that's good if you maintain that. But what happened was that for most people didn't maintain that. So the kids who were really like involved in college sports or really active when they were young, they tended to slack off over the years, and they tended to look like the other people who weren't so active by the time they reached middle age, and that was a real problem. We found that in terms of physical activity, the best predictor, the most important thing, was how active you were in middle age. So if you were out doing something, when you were in middle age, that kept you healthy, and it really didn't matter so much how active you were when you were younger. So it's never too late to start staying active. But then you say, well, what kind of activity? Well, you know, really extreme physical activity turned out not to be necessary. For most people, anything that got them up and out of their chair, that kept them healthy. So if you like gardening, if you like woodworking, if you liked bowling even, anything that kept people away from their screens and, you know, kind of out doing something, that turned out to be really good for most people. So I think public health advice is often wrong when people feel they have to, you know, get out there on the running trails. If you like that, great. But, you know, the people we studied, they weren't even – the Nike company didn't exist in those years. There were a few gyms. But many of them thrived and stayed healthy because in their normal day-to-day activities, they found things they liked to do. So the key is really maintaining some level of activity throughout your life, especially through your 40s and 50s and 60s, and that'll keep you really healthy.
We're talking about the book Longevity Project, Surprising Discoveries for Health and Long Life from the landmark 8-Decade Study, written by Howard Friedman and Leslie Martin, and we have Howard Friedman with us. Your chance to ask a question about this project. I have some of my own, but I'd rather use yours. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 23 minutes past 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This hour we're talking about the Longevity Project. It's a new book by Howard Friedman and Leslie Martin, published by Hudson Street Press. And it's about what goes into living a longer life. It's something, most of us have considered, you know, how long am I going to live? And probably not on a daily basis. That probably doesn't sound too healthy. But I mean, we've all thought about it. How long have I got? And I suppose, you know, you can walk out the door and be hit by a bus. Nobody's guaranteed anything. But some people live to be over 100 years old. Other people die early. What is the difference? What goes into a long life? Wondering what you think. Let me give the phone number again before I go back into my conversation with Professor Friedman. 800-486-8655 is the number to call if you've got a question. 800-486-8655. You can also send us an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. And Professor, there were some other myths that you busted during the course of this study. One is married people live longer.
Well, we always hear that. In fact, we hear get married to live longer, and I think that turned out to be really, really bad advice, incorrect advice, even rotten advice, because we found that it was true. First of all, that the other research findings tend to show not that married people live longer, but that married men live longer. And for women, there's much less evidence that marriage is health beneficial. And we confirmed that. And in fact, we found that for married men who were well-suited to marriage and stayed in a good marriage, that was really good for their health and longevity. So again, men who got married and they were kind of suited for marriage and they had a good marriage and they stayed in it, that was really healthy. But for men who divorced and remained divorced, or for men who remarried and divorced again, the risk of dying skyrocketed. So this, you know, 100% of divorces begin with marriage. So it's really not great advice to encourage everybody to get married if you're not suited or you're not going to have a good marriage, especially for men, because it really was a problem later, partly because they weren't suited for marriage and partly because of the stress of divorce. For women...
Well, let me...
Go ahead.
Well, before we go further with this, I just want to... something you mentioned earlier when we were talking about, happiness and that kind of thing. Isn't this about life choices that people make or things that people do that maybe, for example, they may perhaps one of the reasons that a person would be engaging in what I'll call serial monogamy, a series of bad marriages, is because they make poor choices and maybe they engage in risky behavior. And those things are more of a contributing factor to whether they live longer or not than whether they got married?
Well, that's you're really getting at something that was an important finding. It's really kind of complicated, but I'll try to simplify it. And basically the finding is that what happens in your life is not totally random. We kept seeing that again and again. So you said, well, you could step out the door and be hit by a bus. Well, that's true, and sometimes that happens by chance, just bad luck. But we found again and again and again that it wasn't random, that bad things tended to happen to certain kinds of people and good things tended to happen to other kinds of people. So that's why we talk about guideposts to healthy pathways, because some people, they got on the right path, and one good thing led to another good thing. And, yeah, sometimes just bad luck happened. You don't want to blame victims, and when people get sick for no fault of their own. But so often people were able to help themselves stay healthy. And so that was one of the reasons we wrote the book, because there are things people can do that get themselves on a healthy path. So it wasn't independent. You're right. The people who were more conscientious and prudent and who they went on and got a better education, they went into better marriages, they succeeded more in their careers, they avoided certain unhealthy behaviors, and all those things reinforced each other, and cumulatively, they produced a really big effect. So usually in public health, people look at one variable, eat this, don't eat that, and you're going to get this, 6 months extra life or stay healthier. But we looked at the patterns, the cumulative patterns across people's lives, and when you do that, you're really talking 5, maybe 10 years of increased high-quality life. So really, that's a good lesson that you started to point to, that you can predict across the decades. I mean, think about that. We looked at these children who were, when they were 10 years old, different characteristics, like what their parents said about them, what their teachers said about them, how they interacted with other kids. And those things predicted how healthy they were and how long they were going to live decades later. How did that happen? Well, some of it's genetics, and I don't want to deny that. A lot of people think, well, my parents lived long, I'm going to live long. Well, only about a third of the variation in adult longevity comes from your genes. The rest comes from these other things. Some of it's chance, but a lot of it is what you do, the patterns you're on, the people you interact with, how you behave, and they're not independent. So we found again and again the people who were maybe not on the right path when they were children. They were not prudent, they were not persistent, they were very immature, they were impulsive. By the time they reached young adulthood, many of them had found a good career, had found a good relationship, and that really reduced their risk, and they lived almost as long as the people who were that way all along. So that's the really good news.
Well, I'm glad there is some good news here, because I keep going back to what John Kenneth Galbraith famously said: in the long run, we'll all be dead. Let's take a call, and we'll start with Daryl in Couderay. Daryl, thanks for joining us.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yeah, hi, Daryl. Go ahead.
Okay. I was calling to make a comment and a question. The comment is, I was listening to National Public Radio programming around New Year's, and they were interviewing the oldest living man in the United States, which they said he lives in Minot, North Dakota, and I believe they said he's 114 years old. And they asked him what he attributed his longevity to, and he said he was able to change. And I was wondering what that effect, what you think about that, Professor Friedman.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. Well, first let me say that that's what most people try to do when they want to see the secrets to long life and good health. They look at the oldest people and they say, well, okay, you seem to be, you're 100 years old, you seem pretty happy, and you say you can change, or some of them will say, well, I ate a good salad, or but it turns out that that's not really a great way to approach this question, because it really doesn't matter what these people are saying and doing when they're over 100. You really want to know is, what were they doing when they were 20 and 30 and 40 and 50, right? So it could be the people who were really grumpy and ate something different when they were 40 who were the ones who were saying these kinds of things when they were 100 or 114. So that's the big advantage of the Longevity Project, because it looks earlier in life to see what predicts health step by step later in life. Now, your question about change, we did find that people who could adapt and especially progress was a secret. So it wasn't just that they took whatever came to them, but they persisted. So the men who lived the longest were those who took on increasing responsibilities in their job. It wasn't the ones who said, well, I'll take whatever comes. It was the ones who said, no, I want to achieve more, and they worked harder and they stayed with it. Even after the normal retirement age, they were often involved in something. It didn't have to be the same kind of work, but they were involved maybe in volunteer work, or some of them stuck with it. We found, for example, we studied Norris Bradbury was one of the participants, and he became director of the Los Alamos Research Labs in New Mexico, in charge of our nuclear weapons during the Cold War. And, you know, what could be a more stressful job, being in charge of nuclear research and the weapons programs? And he did it for years, and he got more and more responsibility during his career, and he thrived. He was married, and he had a good family life, and he had good social relationships. But the Longevity Project showed that those people who not only changed but increased their responsibilities and succeeded more and more, they became healthier and healthier.
Daryl, thanks for that call. Let's go to Wausau next and talk with Gabriel. Gabriel, good morning.
Hi. I was wondering if you studied the effect of meditation or prayer on longevity.
Of prayer and what else?
Meditation.
Well,
prayer and meditation.
Well, we did look at religion, and people say that prayer is helpful, and we did find that religious people, especially religious women, tended to stay healthier and live longer. But the nice thing about the Longevity Project is we can go and see, well, what were they doing that made a difference? And it turned out it wasn't the prayer itself that seemed to be so important. It seemed that the people, especially the women who were involved in church activities, they had good social ties. So the more people you interact with each day, also, it turned out that the more you helped other people, which is something that religious people are often urged to do, those people stayed healthier and lived longer. So, you know, it wasn't directly tied to religion. There were other people who were not religious, and they were involved in helping other people and volunteering for their own other reasons. But that did turn out to be healthy and life prolonging. So if you're involved in a religion and you're involved with a lot of other people, especially if you're helping those people, we found out that was really one of the secrets to long life.
Well, that's Gabriel, thank you for bringing that up, because that was exactly where I wanted to go next, because Chapter 12 in your book talks about networking and the power of a social life. I read that, and as a lifelong misanthrope, I thought, boy, I'm in trouble now. How important is it, and I realize this is going to sound like a really stupid question, but I want to ask it anyway, how important is it for human beings to be connected to other human beings in terms of their life expectancy?
For most people, it's very, very important. You know, some people find small numbers of friends. We found some people like that in our study. They had some deep relationships with just a smaller number of people, but most of the people who lived long and stayed healthy were the ones who had good social ties, good social networks. And you might wonder, well, why is that? And we think it's because everybody faces challenges in their each day, each month, each year. And when you have a lot of people around you're interacting with, they help you get over those things. They keep you in line. So, you know, if you have healthy friends, especially, that's a very good thing. You know, if you're associating with people who are out there and involved in some social activity, maybe helping other people, you do that too. And you know, you start feeling sorry for yourself. Well, they get you out there doing something to take your mind off of that. Or if you're heading in a wrong direction in terms of your health habits, you see they're not doing that. So it's partly the groups you associate with. It's partly having the social connections. But basically, there's a lot of research, in addition to our own research in the Longevity Project, that suggests that humans are social creatures, and we need those ties with other people. Again, it doesn't have to be. Some people don't like large numbers of friends. But if you don't have any people you can confide in and associate with, and you don't see many people most days, that turned out to be unhealthy.
Let's go back to the phones. We'll talk to Mary in Stockbridge next. Mary, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick question about the validity of the information that you gleaned from this long-term study, since the initial test population was a a select group for one characteristic, and there doesn't seem to be any control group along with this?
That's a good question, and we spent a lot of time looking into that. Because these were bright boys and girls, and they were mostly white boys and girls, the question is, well, can we talk about other people? Can we generalize the findings? So we spent a lot of time looking at that. We looked at it statistically. We looked at it in terms of other research. And we pretty much find it does generalize. And here's why. Because we were studying things that aren't really particular to this kind of sample. So if I tell you, which I did, that prudent and persistent children tend to stay healthier and live longer, well, that's a personality characteristic, and you know it doesn't really matter how bright you are. If you're of average intelligence and you're bright and you're persistent and prudent and hardworking, well, that's going to be healthy for you too. So on the dimensions that we were studying, it didn't really matter. If we were trying to study something that's related to intelligence, then it would be more of a problem. But since we started collecting these findings about 20 years ago, there have been other follow-ups going on too. And they're pretty much finding the same thing, so that's the best confirmation. Other studies, the following children that started more recently, keep finding that this conscientious prudentness and prudence and hard work do seem to be health protective. So it is something we pay a lot of attention to, and we can't be sure, but we're pretty confident. We've done statistical meta-analyses, which gather up information from lots of studies, and they confirm the same kind of thing, and almost the same size effect.
That reminded me of something, and I remembered seeing this in your book as well. But we have a lot of parents. The concept is called helicopter parents, who they push their kids into preschool, and they really push educational achievement at the earliest possible age. You actually found out that that was something of a myth, that has any advantage. Talk about that a little bit.
That was a really surprising finding that popped out. And, of course, people haven't been able to study this before because nobody's had a study of people throughout their whole lives. But when we looked at the age that the children started school, and because they were bright, some of the parents pushed their kids in to start formal instruction, be in first grade in a formal classroom, before age six, which is quite young, and it turned out that set in motion a bunch of patterns that were unhealthy, and those children who started school too early tended to die sooner later in life. So again, it wasn't absolute. They were kids who did fine with that if they got on the right path later in life, but that was a risk. So we would not recommend that children push their young children into formal education too early in life.
We're talking about the book, The Longevity Project, Surprising Discoveries for Health and Long Life from the landmark 8-decade study by Howard S. Friedman and Leslie R. Martin, published by Hudson Street Press. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We will continue our conversation in just a moment. Lines available if you'd like to call in at 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:41. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Talking about the book, The Longevity Project, with one of its two authors, Howard Friedman. And, Professor, we have a lot of people lined up on the phones who want to talk, so let's go to Green Bay next and hear what Andrew has to say. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Several years ago, Travis Hershey and Michael Gottfredson published a book called The General Theory of Crime, in which they expanded on their famous proclamation. It seems a slogan to me, really, but they said the value is of lambda is zero, and by that they meant that the individual behavior patterns are set early in childhood, and there's no significant variation over the life course. So when you see instability in marriage, in labor force attachment questions or crime, those are really the result of low self-control through poor socialization. And so they argued that, paradoxically to me, it seems that these longitudinal studies aren't even necessary. And what I wanted to know is, when you were looking at these cases, did you find evidence to support these claims, and did the study bear at all on any questions of crime over the life course?
Well, that's a really good, intelligent question. We did find some support for that, so there was some stability. The children who were more impulsive tended to be adolescents and young adults who were more impulsive, and that led into problems later in their life quite often and earlier death. But we also found change, so I wouldn't go along with that there's no variation, no change. In fact, we looked quite carefully at children who were maybe more impulsive when they were very young, and then they became more conscientious when they were midlife, and we compared them to those who went the other way and those who stayed really high or stayed really low on those kinds of dimensions. So we found quite a bit of change, and it made a difference. The good news was if you did change, if you became more prudent, if you became more socially stable and involved, that mitigated a lot of the earlier risk. You never quite caught up to the people who were that way all along, but it didn't make much of a difference. So, yeah, there is definitely some stability, and you can predict who's going to have one problem after another. We didn't have a lot of crimes committed by this group in particular, so we didn't look too much at that. But things associated with that in terms of unstable careers, unstable marriages, problems in their families. We did look at those kinds of things, and we did find both some stability but also a lot of change. And in the book, we have a series of self-quizzes people can take and kind of see where they are on this trajectory and, you know, kind of plot out how they're doing and see if they – and then there are a lot of examples of people who got back on the healthy path. So you can sort of say, well, maybe if I do these kinds of things, I'm going to improve my chances of staying healthy and living longer.
Andrew, thanks for the call. Mike in Milwaukee, you're next. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Hi. I have a partly facetious question in relation to the main one. I'm sure your research doesn't include this, but this might be used for future research. The size of the amygdala, the part of the brain that stores fear-type memories and such, like post-traumatic stress, sexual abuse, and stuff like that. Do you think that might have something to do with whether or not people live longer? And then the other thing is related to this, some research has shown that the size of the amygdala can indicate what party affiliation one has. Conservatives tend to have much larger amygdalas than more liberal people. And I wonder if you couldn't extend the research to find out whether Republicans live longer than Democrats. So there you go.
Well, you see, we have an intelligent audience here. People are someone asked about whether this would generalize to other people. Well, it certainly generalized to this audience. Obviously, you know, intelligent people are listening and calling in. We don't have, of course, direct evidence about the size of the amygdala. That was not known in those days, and we have actually fairly limited biological information about these people anyway. But other studies suggest that about a third of the variation in how long you live is due to your genes. So there's a lot of other things going on, and those are the things that we paid attention to. So yes, there's some limits from how predisposed you are to be fearful and worrying. And we did, as I said earlier, that people who were worriers often did quite well, if it's not extreme. But the interesting thing is that even given your genetics, your biological predisposition, the size of your amygdala, whatever you want to call it, your hormonal balance, you can change. And so things earlier in life predicted things later in life, but not because it was fixed earlier in life, because it led step by step to different outcomes. And that was really a big contribution of the Longevity Project. Because we saw things in childhood when you were 10 predicted things that you were doing in college and predicted things that you were doing in young adulthood and later in your careers and later life and as you aged. So it's kind of like if you go back, you know, if you're, you know, late in life, you go back to your high school reunion and you see people and you say, wow, you know, you turned out kind of like I thought you might. We found a lot of evidence for that. But we also found evidence for the people who changed, and you say, wow, I never thought you would be doing this. So we found both, but you can map out your own trajectories and see that. So that's a really interesting thing. There's both stability and change, but it's step by step, and so that's a really hopeful sign, I think.
Mike, thanks for that call. We'll go to La Crosse next. And Annie, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks. Hey, I was wondering if you took into consideration the types of deaths. I mean, does this take into account just natural deaths, dying of old age? Do all these changes that you talk about, why people live longer, do they have an influence on cancer and heart disease? I mean, that's what I would like to know, and I'll listen on the radio. Thank you very much.
Okay, great question. We did. We've spent many, many years gathering all the death certificates of these people, so it's not so easy to do. These people move to different parts of the country, and they die, and you have to request it from either a state agency or a city or a county, and they have all their own little requirements and fees and so on. But we've tracked them down. We gather them up. We had them professionally coded as to cause of death. So, yes, we do know who died from cancer and who died from heart disease and who died from injury like suicide and so on. And we do find some differences. So predicting to injury death, which is suicides and homicides and accidents, that turned out to be predicted quite well by what's called explanatory style, how you explain things. So if you tend to catastrophize and something bad happens to you and you say, the world is coming to an end, the sky is falling, you know, you're Chicken Little, those kinds of things. If you do that constantly, whenever anything small happens to you, then you're a catastrophizer, and that's kind of bad for your health and long life. So those people were much more likely to die of these kinds of injury deaths. Interestingly, for many other kinds of things, like I talked about, conscientiousness and being in a stable relationship, having good social relationships, they predicted to all kinds of things. So you were less likely to die at an early age of cancer. You were less likely to die at an early age of heart disease, other diseases. We found some indications that some personality predictions were more important for heart disease. And the book goes into those. We call that out whenever there's a particular finding in terms of cause of death. But overall, the message, I think, was that these things affect so many kinds of behaviors and physiologies that are relevant to health that really they impact all causes of death.
Any connection between pet ownership and longevity?
We looked at that. You always hear advice, keep a pet and you'll stay healthy and live longer. And there was a question specifically about that. How often do you play with pets? Which is just what you want to know. Do they play with pets? And we think that pets, of course, are very good for cheering people up and maybe increasing their quality of their life. But when we looked at the length of their lives, it didn't have any effect. So forcing people to get a pet, saying, you know, you better get a pet so you'll stay healthier and live longer, we didn't find that at all. It turned out people who played the most with pets were not any healthier and didn't live any longer than everybody else. So it's great to have pets. We love pets, but as a health intervention, not a great kind of intervention.
Well, I still love my daughter's Labrador. Let's go to Blancherville next and talk with Beatty. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I wanted to know if you looked at birth order of these participants.
Wow, another great question. We did look at birth order, and we did look at other early kinds of things like breastfeeding, and didn't have much of an effect. So it was a middle-class sample. The kids were kind of raised, pretty stably overall compared to the general population, and it didn't much matter if you were firstborn or later born, and it didn't much. The infants were a little healthier if they were breastfed, like other studies show. But by the time they reached, late adolescents, if they were healthy, it didn't much matter what had happened early in their life. So very few things from very early on in life had a traumatic impact in this kind of sample. Now, in a sample where it makes a big difference, you can imagine some cases it really matters if you're firstborn or if you're male or if you've breastfed, we would expect different effects. But here, again, it turned out the step-by-step kinds of things mattered, but no. We did look in some detail at that, and birth order didn't matter.
How important is it to feel as though, you know, you're doing what you're supposed to be doing in terms of your profession, and that you're using your intellect, your talent, the way they're supposed to be used? How important is that level of satisfaction to longevity?
Well, that was interesting. One of the findings was that if your parents divorced when you were a child, that was a risk factor. So it was quite a big, it was really the strongest predictor, a social kind of predictor from childhood, was having your parents divorce. Although the death of a parent was not a problem for your longevity later in life, but divorce was. But just in response to your question, that's what we found was the kind of the antidote to that. So the children who had faced kinds of stresses when they were young, if they had a sense of accomplishment, even by young adulthood, and certainly later in life, that really was a health benefit. So it was the people who persisted with something, stuck with it, kind of the stick-to-itiveness, that helped them thrive. And that's a good predictor. So we have a scale, and in the Longevity Project book, you can assess yourself on that. And if you know you do feel you're accomplished, and you have good social networks, and you're developing a kind of persistence and prudence, it turns out that's a really good sign. You know, there's no guarantees here. This is not, you know, money back guarantee here for longevity. But it turns out there are very stable patterns there, that the people who stayed on these healthy pathways were much more likely to thrive.
Well, here's a question, and this may take us the rest of the hour to discuss, but this came in an email from John in Madison, and just from the name alone, I know that this is going to be a great question already. The question, John writes, the question I have about this study is, what difference does it make? Is long life the goal of life or the essence of life? Is, say, living to age 200 better than living to 100 or 50? Is one cheated by death if one only lives to be 20? If death is the mark of failure, then we all will fail eventually.
Well, that's a good question. We're not trying to extend life beyond any natural limits. We're trying to see why some people stay healthy and thrive and live into their 60s, 70s, 80s, versus people who encounter health problems after health problems or injuries and don't make it. So we're not putting value judgments on this. You know, we're social scientists, health scientists, trying to see why some people can more likely to stay healthy. You look around, and you know, we all know that. Geez, so and so got sick, died, had a heart attack, got cancer, and some of that's beyond their control, and some of it's genetics, and some of it's bad luck. But a lot of it is the things you do. And so I think a lot of people really want to know, well, what can I do to maximize my chances? And that's what the Longevity Project does. It really fills out the details of what people do in their daily lives, in their social relations, in their behaviors, in their habits, that can make quite a significant difference. It's not fad diets. It's not extreme changes. But it's things, good ways to live your life day to day.
We have about a minute and a half. I wanted to ask before we closed here, did this research change any of your habits or your perspective on your own life?
Yeah, a couple of things. One thing is that it turns out that retirement wasn't very good, wasn't very healthy. The idea that you should go sit on a beach and do nothing is kind of a goal for a lot of people, but those people didn't do so well in our study in the Longevity Project. So I think differently about the possibility of retiring someday. I would want to stay involved in something important and something meaningful. So that's one lesson I took. Another thing is we found that we busted an old myth that says the best of men cannot suspend their fate. The good die early and the bad die late. You always hear that the good die young. But we found that was a myth. In fact, our findings, they repeatedly revealed that it was the honest, the dependable, the hardworking, the helpful, and the socially involved individuals who thrived. So we summarize that by saying, generally speaking, it's the good ones who can actually help shape their fate. The bad die early, and the good do great.
Oh, that's excellent. And just in a short time here, if you can give me a couple of sentence answer, did we end the debate of nature versus nurture, or are we just adding fuel to the fire?
Well, it's both. I mean, we found both. There's clearly some things that you're born with and some things that you have in terms of your biological development, but there are a lot of things that influence that. So the biology is expressed in a certain social context across your life, and the Longevity Project shows how that unfolds with lots of different stories and anecdotes, as well as the statistics in the book.
All right. Great place to leave it. Thank you very much, Professor Friedman. What an interesting hour. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for great questions.
Howard Friedman is a distinguished professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside, and co-author of Longevity Project, Surprising Discoveries for Health and Long Life from the landmark 8-decade study, published by Hudson Street Press. Chrissy Pease produced this hour of programming, and Katie Mattson handled on-air production. Thanks for tuning in. Be back tomorrow with a couple more hours of interesting stuff here on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.